Okay, good evening and welcome everybody. Thanks for coming so numerously. My name is Uli Sedemeyer. I'm chairing the session today, so don't believe what you saw in the adverts for the event. It's me chairing it. I will introduce the panelists to my right, Waltraud Schelkle here from the European Institute, an associate professor in the political economy of Europe. Waltraud is an expert for our purposes on finance and monetary integration in Europe. To my very left, Abby Innes, an assistant professor in political economy of Europe, also here at the European Institute. And again, what is relevant in Abby's research for us today is especially her expertise in post-communist Central Europe and the role of the state in transformation. And last but not least, it's my special pleasure to introduce Rachel Epstein. Professor Rachel Epstein is a professor of international relations, European studies at the University of Denver. Maybe just to say two words about how Rachel, no, that's probably too ambitious to say how she got there, but a little bit more of her previous intellectual journey. Rachel's research has always been inspired by an interest in post-communist transformation in Central and Eastern Europe, starting with the influence of international institutions like the European Union, but also NATO or the IMF on the post-communist transformation. Also looking at some of the unintended consequences of that influence and the somewhat less savory influences that those international institutions have had. And her research in that area has spanned a range of policy areas from agriculture to finance and defense. So that's the initial research agenda that Rachel had, and sort of one of the key outputs here was a book entitled In Pursuit of Liberalism, International Institutions in Post-Communist Europe, that came out with Johns Hopkins University Press. And from there, Rachel has moved on looking still at post-communist Europe, but with a specific focus on banking and in a more comparative perspective with Western Europe and beyond. And indeed, one of the key outputs is the reason why we're here today. It's her book that we're going to discuss now, Banking on Markets, which came out last year with Oxford University Press. The way we agreed to do the talk today is that Rachel is going to introduce the book briefly, then our other two panelists are going to have a couple of questions and comments in conversation with Rachel, and then later on we're going to open it up to discussion. Thank you very much. Thanks, and welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you all so much for coming. It's a total pleasure to be here. I have many friends and great colleagues at LSE, and I want to especially thank these three, and especially Waltraud, for helping to organize the talk tonight and to give me an opportunity to talk to you about this book that I've published, and I will put the cover up here, which is called Banking on Markets. And I just want to, in the first 15 minutes, talk about some of the major arguments in the book, so that for those of you who haven't read it, which I'm sure is most of you at this point, you have some sense of where I'm starting the project. So there is a central argument in the book, which is the following. It is simply that for a very long time in the European context, but in many parts of the world other than Europe too, banks and governments have had a very special and in some ways mutually supportive, in some cases mutually destructive relationship. And what I argue in the book is that on a macro level across the EU, East and West, this special reinforcing symbiotic kind of relationship is undergoing a profound and fundamental change. And this has implications then for how Europeans govern their polity from the supranational level, but also has implications for the amount of national discretion the governments in the EU have vis-a-vis managing their political economies. And what I do in the manuscript is to explain why it is that these changes are taking place, and specifically the change I'm interested in is the elevation in the power and role of markets at the expense of politics. Right, so the book explains why this is happening both in East and West Europe. And then the book also explains what, to date, the distributional consequences of that change has been. So in Western and Eastern Europe, what I argue in the book is that the effect of the attempt to remove politics from finance has not been bad and will not be bad for volatility, which is a surprise for some, but it does potentially have negative consequences for adjustment and competitiveness. So I'm going to say a few things about each of those three components in the next 12 minutes or so. So as Willy just explained, my original research was on the role of international institutions in Eastern and Central Europe in the transition and what those international financial but also security institutions were trying to do early on was to liberalize policy outcomes in the post-communist countries, speaking primarily of the countries that ended up joining both the European Union and NATO ultimately. One of the things that was going on in the 1990s and early 2000s is the international financial institutions, but also the US Treasury, were making a big push to implement liberal economics in part through the privatization of financial sectors with foreign capital. And you can see that in Eastern Europe, this was quite effective. With the exception of Slovenia, all of the East European countries end up with very high levels of foreign bank ownership. Therefore, when it comes to this first question that I asked at the outset, why is it that the Europeans are undergoing this profound transformation of taking national politics out of banking? In Eastern Europe, it really started with the post-communist transition and the push, both by foreign financial institutions and by supranational agencies and by the US government, to encourage these countries to privatize their banks with foreign capital. And I have to tell you also, maybe it won't surprise you, that part of the agenda was precisely in the post-communist world to try to get politics out of finance, to try to get communist-era networks out of the management of the economy in the first instance. All right, so what you see on the left-hand side is already, in a sense, the severing of bank-state ties because of the introduction of foreign bank ownership on a very high level in Eastern Europe. What you see in Western Europe, by contrast, and this is critical to the next slide I'm going to explain to you, is that banking sector protectionism was rampant in Western Europe at the same time that the West Europeans were encouraging high levels of openness in Eastern Europe. So what I'm explaining in this slide is why we get the weakening or the severing of bank-state ties in Eastern Europe, but you can see at this point, in 2008 and still actually in 2013, the West Europeans, and especially the four largest Eurozone economies, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, they have an impulse to try to maintain control of the financial institutions in their jurisdiction. And one of the main arguments in the book is for the West Europeans, having a politically susceptible banking sector has always been very desirable because banks have traditionally been a source of credit. They've helped governments manage the macroeconomy. They've helped governments manage crisis response. They've helped governments consolidate political support insofar as financial sectors have often in the European context, but elsewhere in the world also, been the channel through which you could fund favored industries, sectors, political constituencies. So this relationship between banks and governments has been very critical to the governance of West European political economies for a very long time. Okay, so now still on the first argument about why it is we're seeing the transformation of bank-state ties, what I told you about Eastern Europe is that that transformation started in the 90s and 2000s with the introduction of very high levels of foreign bank ownership. The explanation for Western Europe is different, and it rests most recently in the European debt and currency crisis. What this chart is showing you is the extent to which, at the depths of the crisis, 2011-2012, we saw the linked fortunes of banks and governments and government finances in a way that made the politics in banking seem very dangerous. So what this chart is showing you are the spiking borrowing costs of West European Eurozone states. And as those government borrowing costs are rising, at the same time, the quality of banks' balance sheets resting in those jurisdictions were deteriorating, and that is because those banks had purchased disproportionate shares of their own sovereign's debt. And you might ask, well, why did they do that? That doesn't seem like a very good idea when the fiscal position of the governments in question are in doubt. But they did it for very political reasons. So what we see in this slide is the fact that the political relationships between banks and governments encouraged a kind of relationship in which politically susceptible banks then lent disproportionately to their governments. And so the financial fortunes of both governments and banks in these Eurozone countries were very strongly linked, which is why you get the term of a bank-state doom loop. And part of what makes this dynamic even more dangerous, and made it very dangerous in 2011 and 2012, is that as the fiscal fortunes were tightly linked, the EU member states ended up spending a fortune on bank bailouts, right? And so that increases the financial fragility, again, of both the banks involved and the governments. And you can see up there, EU members spent 1.6 trillion euros on banks by 2013. So if this dynamic is revealing to us that there is a certain kind of danger and fragility inherent in the bank-state relationships that were prevailing up until this period, then the answer to this problem is that from a West European Eurozone, European Banking Union point of view, you somehow need to sever the bank-state ties that are causing this very negative dynamic. So the severing or the weakening of those ties is manifested in the thing called European Banking Union, which is this institutional innovation which comes into play between 2012 and 2014. And essentially, by supranationalizing the oversight of financial institutions in the EU's jurisdiction, it makes banks politically much less susceptible than they were before. And it doesn't allow states to extend to the same extent regulatory forbearance and restricted competition that banks had previously enjoyed. Okay, so on both sides of the continent, you have a push for a kind of depoliticization in the governance of banks. In the Eastern European context, you had transition. In the West European context, you have the European debt and currency crisis, which is really pushing in the same direction of depoliticization. Okay, so then, in terms of how the argument progresses in the book, one of the reasons that West European states, but not just West European states, states all over the world have tried to limit foreign ownership in their banking sectors is because they have often feared that in the context of a crisis, foreign banks will abandon the host market under stress. So what you're seeing up here is a reflection of this belief that foreign banks, mostly domiciled in Western Europe, would, when it came to the US financial crisis and their investments in Eastern Europe, would leave those markets in Eastern Europe high and dry, would repatriate capital and liquidity, which would leave the East Europeans with a very severe credit crunch, have negative impacts on output and employment. And what you have here is Paul Krugman essentially saying, Eastern Europe in 2008 looks a lot like Asia, Southeast Asia in 1997, right? And that would have been a catastrophic outcome. I have to say, at the time that Paul Krugman published this particular blog post, I shared his concerns about this dynamic because you had those very high levels of foreign ownership. You had West European governments and banks under tremendous pressure, and it looked like a situation in which, in fact, the West European owners might abandon their East European markets. So one of the things that the book covers, which I'm sure my discussants are also going to talk about, is this, which is basically showing you that phenomenon of West European multinational banking groups abandoning their East European markets didn't happen in 2008 and 2009. And this came as a surprise to me, to Paul Krugman, and to many other analysts looking at the situation and being fearful about how foreign owners would treat their host markets. So essentially what this is telling you is that the cutting and running episode that was anticipated in 2008-2009 never took place. And then there is a further set of arguments here about why that was the case. There is a kind of conventional wisdom which suggests that the Vienna Initiative, which was orchestrated in large measure by something called the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, organized something called a voluntary bank rollover agreement, which persuaded the foreign financial institutions to stay. I argue instead that it was a function of the particular business models that West European bankers were pursuing in Eastern Europe, and I hope that we have an opportunity to talk about that issue more. But essentially what I conclude from this episode is that under certain institutional circumstances, if you are a country that has high levels of foreign bank ownership in your jurisdiction, it need not necessarily be a source of volatility and vulnerability for you. Under the same, difficult to replicate, I will admit, but under the same institutional conditions, other countries around the world could protect themselves against capital withdrawal through banking sectors if they have the right institutional context. So what I'm arguing here is that in terms of volatility, the severing of bank-state ties is not necessarily a bad thing. Moreover, and I want to be mindful of time, but moreover, I want to say that if you compare the outcomes in Eastern Europe, where levels of foreign bank ownership were high, and you compare that to Western Europe, where you had low levels of foreign bank ownership but very high levels of cross-border bank flows, Western Europe had much more volatility in this episode than in Eastern Europe, precisely because there wasn't foreign ownership, because there was no long-term stake among creditors across borders, and so what you got in Western Europe instead was really a retreat behind national borders and what the industry calls a home bias lending, which was incredibly damaging in terms of the effectuation of monetary policy and in terms of trying to combat downturns in the most harshly stricken crisis countries, right? So what I take from this episode is that foreign bank ownership in some senses and the transnationalization of ownership of banks can really be a stabilizing force in terms of funding through crisis, which is the opposite of the conventional wisdom and certainly not what policymakers think when they continue to protect their banking markets from foreign owners. So we're good on volatility. This is my last slide. So what I've told you so far, just to reiterate, there are different reasons for the severing of bank-state ties on the different sides of the continent. But between post-communist transition and the introduction of European Banking Union, you have this concerted effort across Europe to remove politics from banking. And I've told you so far that it's a net positive, I think, for limiting volatility. The book, though, also points to a concern, which I'm sure we're going to talk about more on the panel, which is that, you know, if we think that banks and governments have traditionally had a special kind of relationship in Europe in which governments have used banks to supply credit, consolidate political support, combat crises, right? They do all that. And then you have the weakening of bank-state ties where they can no longer do that. Right? That raises some alarm bells about how much national discretion policymakers have if they no longer have a politically susceptible majority domestically owned or managed banking sector. Essentially what we're saying in this scenario is that governments lose one of the important tools that they have traditionally used to manage their macroeconomies. And what I find in the book, when it comes to Eastern Europe, which is still, economically speaking, along some measures, very behind their West European counterparts, this turns out to be a major impediment to catching up in terms of competitiveness and also income, and developing innovative capacities that will, in the longer term, help those countries catch up. All right, so we've seen quite negative political developments in a number of the East European countries, which in one way is puzzling because in overall GDP growth terms, those countries have done extraordinarily well in the transition and certainly since membership in the EU. But there is a continuing concern in that part of the world with inequality and with not being able to enjoy the same standards of living and privileges as West European counterparts. In some sense, EU enlargement has been a huge disappointment for the East European populations for not delivering on this presumed promise of equality faster, right? So when you're talking about who controls finance, who has national discretion, who can use the financial sector as a tool of sorts, what you find in many of the East European countries is that they lack this tool and therefore they feel like they lack the wherewithal to deploy catching-up strategies. And this is a source of enormous frustration and political dissatisfaction. And then, it probably won't come as a surprise to you, the countries like Poland and Hungary are trying to reverse the high levels of foreign bank ownership, which I just told you are actually a plus for containing volatility, right? So people are very worried about this response. In terms of the West European states, it's also potentially problematic in the sense that these countries, political economies, are on top of the economic pile in a way in global comparative economic terms. But again, if they want to be able to have as many tools at their disposal as possible for the purposes of maintaining competitiveness, there is concern the supranationalization of oversight, which means the weakening of bank-state ties, will also potentially put them at a competitive disadvantage to the extent that they lose national discretion over the governance of their own political economies. So those are the main findings and arguments of the book, and I look very much forward to my discussants' reactions. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rachel. We start with Abhi. Abhi's going to have a couple of comments and questions, but we try to make it a bit more interactive, also being mindful of the late hour and to keep your interest, make sure the jet lag doesn't kick in, and Rachel can still follow. So, over to you, Abhi.
Brilliant. Well, in the first place, I just want to congratulate you on the book. I really recommend this book. It's fantastic. It pulls together a very fragmented literature on finance in Central Europe in particular, so it gives you that synoptic view of what's been said so far, and then it adds this incredibly illuminating insight into how it's been evolving and debunks some myths, I think. And if you, when we talk about a robust argument to students, if you want to get a really good example of what a robust argument looks like, look at the debunking of the argument that the Vienna Initiative was decisive in stabilizing Central Europe in the crisis, because it's pretty persuasive. Okay, in terms of questions, I really to expand on what you've said. One of the things that you're very nuanced about is the degree to which this model can be exported elsewhere in terms of if we look specifically at this idea of the second home country model that the Central European, the Austrian and German banks in particular and the Italian banks in Central Europe didn't cut and run in the crisis, contrary to what was expected, because they viewed it as a second home market. The home market that they were coming from was overbanked. Central Europe was underbanked, had fantastic prospects for the future, and so there was this real determination, but also a cultural affinity, particularly for Austria in terms of its historical relationship with the region, to stick it out. But I wondered if there was an additional dimension to that, which was that it's particularly dependent as a second home country model to be virtuous and long-term in its outlook on the fact that the home banks were coming from coordinated market economies. So would, if these, hypothetically, if these had been British and American banks, would the second home banking model be nearly so virtuous? Would it have been much more short-term, much more stimulating of credit booms, of excessive borrowing, rather over-responsive to volatility? So is it the case that virtuous foreign banks tend to be from coordinated market economies like Austria and Germany?
So thank you for that question. I'm always eager to talk about the Vienna Initiative because I think so much reporting about it has been inaccurate. So Just to give a little bit more context, what I mentioned in the talk initially is that the EBRD, among other institutions, but in coordination with the IMF and also the European Commission, has an argument out there that they persuaded multinational banks, as Abby said, not to cut their exposures in Eastern Europe. And as it turns out, the Vienna Initiative actually started with six of the largest West European banks investing in Eastern Europe, which is to say that in the fall of 2008, essentially in response to that Krugman blog post that I just referred to, that blog post fomented so much panic in the region because many people looking at the situation assumed that Eastern Europe was going to fall off the face of the earth because of the withdrawal of West European multinational banking groups. So essentially, what I argue in the book is that those six financial institutions, which were from France, Austria, and Italy, that they actually got the ball rolling in terms of activating the international organizations to create a context in which the panic about the situation could be alleviated. In terms then of, well, is that a replicable model? If we're going to say that foreign bank ownership doesn't necessarily induce volatility and vulnerability, what are the conditions under which a foreign entrant to your banking market might not kill you in a crisis? And there are some things specific to the European context that makes it more likely that in Europe this is going to have a positive effect instead of an increasing volatility effect. Those things include the following, which are, in theory, replicable in other parts of the world. The first thing that's notable about the West European method of expansion in Eastern Europe is that they did it through subsidiaries. Right, this gets into a slightly arcane area of banking regulation and oversight. But essentially, if you set up your foreign operations through subsidiaries, it means the host government has more authority over you and you have more accountability to those host regulators and supervisors than you would if you set up as branches. And certainly, those host authorities have more control over you than if you're engaging in cross-border lending. So that's the first thing. Subsidiaries are potentially stabilizing. The second thing, and this is harder to replicate, right, but it has, I think, less to do with the variety of capitalism that we're talking about than just the relative size of markets that we're talking about. The thing about the French, the Austrian, and the Italian investors in Eastern Europe is that they were going to a new market of at least 100 million new customers. Right, and so what was really important for those six banks that got together and started the Vienna Initiative is that they were dependent on the foreign markets for large proportions of their revenue, and that was really critical. So I would distinguish even between the United States as an investor and the British as investors, because the U.S. market is so much bigger. And indeed, if you look at U.S. investment in Latin America, including through the subsidiary model, American banks have not always held fast and supported their foreign affiliates. And I think it has to do with the relative size of the market. So that's the second thing. It behooves you as a host to invite in foreign investors who are coming from actually relatively small domestic markets because you precisely you want to cultivate their dependence on you in a way. The third thing that I would say in the European case, which is different, but not actually exceptional, and people will have mixed feelings about this, but one of the things that contributed to a longer-term commitment among West European bank groups, especially in the Austrians' case, is they had an imperial legacy in this part of the world. Right? The second home market is partly a reflection of the feeling, at least among Austrian bankers, that they really were operating in their home market. This was territory that they had formally controlled, right? And so there is a sense in which there's an ideational, sociological connection. And one of the CEOs of one of the large Austrian banks told me, we were never prepared to close the door on a bank. Now, of course, he would tell me that, right? I'm a researcher coming to shine light on West European multinational banking groups in Eastern Europe, right? So I'm not so naive. But there is a sense, and it was repeated by another Austrian CEO, that these historical legacies also mattered, right? those historical legacies you find in many parts of the world with both negative and positive connotations, I would say.
Brilliant. Thank you. Okay, I've got one shorter question and then a methodological question, which is more for the social scientists rather than the bankers in the room. So, but for the first question is, the shorter question is really about, you make this great distinction in the book, which is that foreign banks didn't cut and run, but the dominance of foreign banks really inhibits the catch-up and the developmental processes domestically because governments can't direct finance capital to innovation and to skills upgrading and so on. And I wondered if the picture is perhaps even more problematic and this is a question which is about how much of the foreign bank investment was really going to domestic enterprises. So they're very keen on the retail mortgage market and the credit market, but in terms of investment in SMEs, do you know what the trends have been over time? Because in Poland, there's quite a lot of evidence, or at least I've seen sort of a variety of studies that suggest that the majority of Polish SMEs still reinvest their own profits as the main source of finance capital. So it's still kind of primitive capital accumulation. And that may also explain why Poland was the only country that kept growing in the bust in the global financial crisis, because if you've been credit starved for the entire transition, then a credit bust is neither here nor there. It's business as usual, which is not a particularly positive picture. So certainly it's been part of the rhetoric of justice, law and justice in terms of justifying the renationalization of banking. Now, over 50% of Polish bank assets are state-owned over the last 2 years. That this is a completely neglected sector. Is that what you see?
So that is what the evidence shows. That is, foreign financial institutions are not as good at seeking out local entrepreneurs for financing, and this could be one of the problems that we observe in East European catching up strategies. It's been the strategy of East European catching up has largely been predicated on foreign direct investment. And in certain sectors of these economies, this has been a boon for wages and skills and living standards. But it also introduces a lot of inequality, and there's a lot of unevenness with respect to which locally owned firms emerge to supply the cross-national value chains that multinational companies are implanting in these countries. So all of this is to reinforce what Abby just said about the problems of catching up. And the economist on East Central Europe that's done a lot of this research most directly is John Bonin. And indeed, he and his colleagues find that while foreign financial institutions have been very good at financing foreign direct investment, mortgages, consumer finance of other kinds, including in autos and credit cards, they have not been stellar at seeking out local entrepreneurs. This is a concern. And, you know, the other thing I would say, though, is in one part of the book, I do an exploration in five of the post-communist countries of which of the remaining domestically owned banks show promise in this area, right? So this is the other side of what you're saying. Right, so I'm affirming what Abby's saying. It's difficult to get foreign financial institutions to fund the right stuff, okay? On the other hand, it's not clear that domestic financial institutions are a lot better at this. And so in one part of the book, I'm comparing Slovenia, Bulgaria, Poland, Hungary, and it turns out that the domestically controlled financial institutions in Poland and Hungary are pretty focused not just on profitability, but also on the domestic economy, its health, and its recovery from the crisis. But in Bulgaria, Slovenia, and Latvia, it's a very different story. And I don't have the same confidence in those countries that domestic ownership would give a huge leg up, right? So there's lots of evidence from around the world of domestic financial institutions also failing to live up to the, let's say, economic aspirations of their political apparatuses.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, I can come back later this time.
Later,
yeah, yeah.
So
Okay, let me start with saying that I advanced from the chair to the panelists, if that's an advance, because Eric sends his apologies. He was squeezed from two sides by a commitment he had for 8 o'clock tonight, and then it was brought forward, and he really regrets that he can't be here and sends his congratulations on the book. And because I replace Eric, I will stick up for the Vienna Initiative a little bit, although I think it's actually compatible with your arguments, and I found it very informative how you discuss it. Let me also say, this is a wonderful book full of detail that you may not know. I'm very sympathetic, for example, to this search in simple institutions you find a functionality that comes out only under stress, so that subsidiaries or branches make a big difference for how much risk sharing you have in a banking crisis, namely that you can push some on foreigners, right? And that's an important thing, and that we hope also to have in the euro area. And I think the banking union will help to create, and that's what Rachel also says. Or noting that national, it's a book that has a lot of bold claims, but at the same time a lot of nuance in which they condition some of the bold claims in the end. For example, the national state bank ties are as often a problem as they are a solution for catching up, she shows, and you have just referred to it. And China is right now in the conclusions of the book, she makes exactly this observation, how China is now trying to get out of this close embrace with its banking system. My comment gets to something I think that's really at the core of our interest as political economists, namely whether you do not in your book underplay a bit the relevance of public safety nets. And this is where I stick up for the Vienna Initiative. But let me say first, what was important, and I think why Eastern and Central Europe got so well out of the crisis, was because it was a crisis we knew and knew how to fight it. Because to that extent, Paul Krugman was right, it was a replay of the Asian crisis. Countries that are fundamentally a bit vulnerable, but who is not vulnerable in such a crisis, but have their own currencies and have a lot of foreign debt, actually more than most of Southeast Asian countries. And so one knew immediately we have to stop a currency crisis. And what they then got was not, many people obviously said they got so well out of the crisis because they could devalue. Actually, they could only devalue after they were made part of larger currency areas through all these swap arrangements that the big central banks, Federal Reserve or, ahead of them, ECB, Swiss National Bank, and the Swedish Riksbank put up, and help them to completely eliminate the foreign exchange constraint. Well, then it's very nice to do an orderly devaluation, but this is not a privilege that many Latin American countries had. And in that context, if basically the central banks that can provide the foreign exchange that these countries need, if then banks say, and we want an initiative that solves our collective action problem, that we all have to stay in, and make it a self-fulfilling success, tide all of us over this problem, then that is effective. And the Vienna Initiative, they need it still, because commercial actors never can quite guarantee that they will do it, because there may be shareholders that say, why are we just staying in this risky place? If there is then a public sector that says, you stay in and we back you up if you do, but we punish you if you don't, then that is very effective. And I think that was a role of the Vienna Initiative, but in that limited sense, and it was interesting to me that actually the banks made the first offer. The European Banking Union, in a similar way, Rachel calls in her book the Euro a liberalizing movement. And some of the institutions like bail-in rules, so that the first 80% of capital have to be contributed basically by the shareholders, which they always should do, that we have to write that now into law is actually a bit funny, because capital requirements are now at 8% and they should always take the first hit. But, you know, since we socialized all the downward risk and still have privatization of the upward risk, you have to now be very explicit about it. That's all what the bail-in rules say. But that is what then Rachel calls marketization of state-bank ties. Now, to me, that sounds as if the markets can do it for themselves, which I don't believe. The euro and such rules are public instruments, regulatory instruments, to force risk pooling, which the markets usually undo exactly at the moment where we should it all stick to it. So that gives then the nation states in these ties additional instruments, but not by giving them national discretion over them, but exactly instruments to share their risks by sharing with others, by risk pooling. And so a common currency and common monetary policy, which plays hardly any role in the looking at the European Banking Union, that reduces liquidity risks, resolution funds financed by the industry, and this European deposit insurance scheme, insurance scheme, they would all be ways of forcing the markets to insure themselves, always with the backing of a public sector. And my evidence for this is that what you describe as the a bit, you sound in some parts in this chapter about European Banking Union as if it's the first time that we do anything together about banks. Now, there was a financial sector action plan under the single market program. After all, financial services for a long time were not an issue for the euro area. And before that, even the Basel rules. We have supranationalization of banking regulation and supervision already before the European Banking Union. And this is, in my view, because all governments have noticed that any banking system is now too big for any fiscal authority to take on by themselves. And the bank budget doom loops, as you refer to, show exactly that as well. And in that sense, I feel this has nothing to do with liberalization, marketization, but with risk pooling that includes private channels of risk pooling. So my question is, can we understand the advances in safety really if we call all that marketization and liberalization?
Good. Okay, thanks, Walter. So on the first part of the question about the Vienna Initiative, I think you're right, it is compatible in the following sense. Right, what I object to about the portrayals of the Vienna Initiative, and this comes out pretty strongly in the book, is that there is this argument, and researchers from the IMF have come to the conclusion that the following thing mattered. That the international financial institutions forced, I'm putting that in quotations because I think it's not true, forced a number of the multinational banking groups to keep their exposures in an explicit way to the East European markets. And the claim is then that this voluntary bank rollover agreement was the thing that kept these banks invested. In fact, I think Valtrout's story is much closer to mine in the sense that it was in these multinational banking groups' market interest to stay. And when they tell me they had no intention of leaving, the empirics on the ground back that up because they had spent the last decade and a half to two decades fighting for market share in these new markets, which were far larger in most cases than their home markets. So what I'm doing in the book is debunking the idea that this voluntary bank rollover agreement was the thing that secured continuing exposures, and arguing that instead it was the multinational banking groups themselves who first authored a letter to the EBRD, to the G20, to the European Commission, objecting to the national emphasis on repatriating capital and liquidity behind national borders. What was happening at the time that the Vienna Initiative was started is that you had politicians in Austria, in France, in Italy saying, we don't want our bank bailout funds going to foreign markets. And I have to tell you, I was doing interviewing in Poland in 2011. It was one of the first countries I visited. And even to Polish ears, this reasoning made sense, that national taxpayer money going to bail out financial institutions by Italian taxpayers in Italy should not then be transferred over to Poland to help the Polish market, right? So even if this makes sense to the Polish nationalist and the Italian nationalist, it did not make sense to Raiffeisen or Erste Bank or UniCredit, who are the multinational West European banking groups invested in Eastern Europe. These guys were essentially fighting against the nationalism which was manifesting itself in their own countries, against a ring-fencing strategy in which aid to failing financial institutions could not be used across their multinational banking groups in a way that the bank managers saw fit, right? So it's Herbert Stepich at Raiffeisen who's telling these international financial institutions, you guys need to get on our side to fight our national politicians so that nationalism does not win the day, so that the logic and the spirit underpinning the functioning of the single market is not destroyed in this financial crisis. Right, so in that sense, the public assistance that then flowed and is associated with the Vienna Initiative, including by a number of the central banks that you referred to, was very much a product of those multinational banks groups' mobilization of the supranational institutions behind their cause. But what I want to emphasize is it starts with those multinational bank groups, and moreover, those guys didn't care about getting the credit for this. What they wanted was the assistance, and more importantly, the other thing that's going on at this time, the Raiffeisens, the Erstes, the PNB Paribas type banks, because they have big exposures in Eastern Europe, because Paul Krugman is saying this is just going to be like Asia in 1997, they themselves develop a financing problem. Other financial institutions no longer want to extend credit to these guys. So they have a massive public relations problem on their hands. And this is why it then became very instrumental and helpful and productive for them to enlist the energies and support and public aid, risk sharing, as you put it, of the other relevant actors, including the supranational institutions, including the central banks in question. This was also very strongly in evidence, as you say, in Scandinavia, and the relationship between the Riksbank and the Baltic states especially. Right? So what I'm emphasizing here is that the Vienna Initiative was important. Right? I'm not saying it's not important. If we didn't have the Vienna Initiative, these economies would have been in much deeper trouble. But it was because of the panic that was being fomented, partly by the industry, partly by the media, partly by the EBRD, honestly. And so somehow those multinational bank groups had to nip that panic in the bud, and they did it by mobilizing the international financial institutions and getting aid in support of their cause, which, productively in this case, was also in support of the East European economies and markets, so that they didn't suffer the same devastation that Southeast Asia did in the late 1990s. I would say on the risk pooling part of European banking union, the reason that I refer to those policy, right, maybe it's too much to call them innovations because a lot of it's already existing policy and a recognition that there should be a bail-in principle at work, right? And what this means and what the bank recovery and resolution directive does in the European Union is try to get taxpayers off the front lines of bailouts, right? So what Valtrat is saying is, there should be more risk sharing among actors, including private ones. These guys should take a loss first. And what the European legislation has essentially said in the meantime is, yes, absolutely, before taxpayers are called upon, the private actors here should be held accountable first, should suffer losses first. Right? So that's part of what's accompanied European Banking Union is the BRRD, to try to get taxpayers off the front lines. But I still think, Valtraud, that it involves an elevation in the power and also liability of those private actors, in the sense that the IMF has done calculations about how much money financial institutions save because of the fact that there are implicit bank guarantees across the globe, right? So in theory, if you, as an investor, as a shareholder, some kind of creditor vis-a-vis a financial institution, if you no longer live with the belief that your banks are very likely going to be bailed out in the event of a crisis by the taxpayer, it makes you much more alert and concerned and active with respect to how you extend your credit. And so in that sense, I do think it's an elevation of the role of private actors. The other sense in which I think it is an elevation of the role of private actors is that in theory, and we have yet to see how the ECB and this single supervisory mechanism acts on this authority, but the single supervisory mechanism in the ECB has become the sole bank licensing authority in the Eurozone. That means to the extent that banks within domestic markets enjoyed protection from foreign entrants especially, it's now under the ECB's discretion to decide whether those foreign entrants will be able to come in or not. In theory, then, this really breaks up the regulatory forbearance dynamic and also the protection against foreign entrants dynamic. It means that going forward, from a banking union architect's point of view, it would be very desirable if you had much more transnational ownership in the Eurozone, also as a means of pooling risk. Right? So I would say that pooling risk and the elevation of market actors are also not necessarily incompatible objectives, but are rather parallel tracks that the European authorities are trying to put into place together.
I think we should open and then I perhaps add.
Okay. Thanks a lot to the discussants. Obviously, you can come back in later, so it's not the final word. But let's open it up. Maybe if you can just introduce yourselves briefly and give your affiliation, if you're a student, say which department you're from, for example. Should we start right there in the front row?
Hello. My name is Orkun Saka. I'm a postdoc at the European Institute LSE. Thanks for the talk. I think it's a very interesting subject, and also for my own research interests, it's very fitting to what I study, especially recently. But I was actually surprised to see that you shed a little bit of a more positive light on the state bank ties, because I was expecting you to be pessimistic in line with the general economics literature. And in that literature, there are many seminal papers showing that as much as these banks can be a useful tool to respond properly to the crisis or to the financial distress, they can also be used in normal times by the politicians to manipulate the elections, to help their allied connections to get reelected. And for instance, Turkey is, I think, a nice case study in that respect. Because what we have seen in the global financial crisis is that Turkish state banks actually responded very positively to the financial crisis, in the sense that they have kind of replaced the credit that was withdrawn by the private banks in Turkey. So that was kind of a success story from that point of view. But at the same time, there are many criticisms on the Turkish state banks saying that the current government is actually manipulating the credit given to certain regions, especially they are rewarding the regions that are allied with them and kind of punishing the ones that are non-allied. And actually that's also part of my research. And I want to just know, like, what's your take on that part of the analysis? Are we kind of ignoring? Are we kind of ignoring in this whole discussion that they can also be destructive in terms of democracy and elections?
So thank you for that question. So as Faltraut said, the overall message of the book is that the Europeans might not lose a lot by weakening bank-state ties in a way that precludes the sort of relationship that you're talking about that are still alive and well in Turkey. That's the general conclusion, but there's a big caveat, which is that in many of the countries that I study, and particularly in Eastern Europe, some of the banks during the crisis that were domestically owned, and in one case majority state owned at the time, performed exceptionally well. right? So the main case that I'm talking about here is in Poland, and there's this state-owned bank that at the time of the crisis was majority state-owned, called PKO BP. And what happened during the crisis is that foreign banks were nervous, more nervous than PKO BP. PKO BP has some ties to the government, right, because it's majority state-owned, but they have also an independent management board. They expanded their lending during the crisis. Their money management business grew. They attracted more depositors from other parts of the banking sector because it was a domestic brand. People knew that. They trusted it. They didn't think they were going to be abandoned. So it had these kinds of advantages. It also did some really large, important large-scale lending to enterprises that were in deep trouble in the crisis, where they couldn't get financing from their regular sources of credit. PKO BP stepped in. As Abby referred to, right, this is a bank that at the time of the crisis had about 20% of the market share, could have been one of the things that really reduced the impact of the crisis on Poland's economy overall, is the fact that this bank stepped into a kind of gap that was created by the largely majority-owned banking market and, you know, made a conscious effort because they believed that the fate of the national economy was at stake, to increase lending and increase also strategic lending. Right, so then the question becomes, well, that was the case in Poland. Why wasn't that the case in Latvia? I mean, essentially you had a Latvian domestically owned bank failure in 2008, 2009, which was the cause of the need for Latvia to bring in the IMF for a rescue, right? So you have bank behavior, which is polar opposite, but both of these in this context are domestically owned. So what I argue in the book is there are a set of political institutions underpinning bank behavior, which is a combination of nationalism on the one hand, right? Nationalism plays a positive role in some instances in connection with political competition. And if you have this sort of sweet spot of bankers caring about the fate of the national economy and being in touch with the political class about the ways in which a particular financial institution could assist the national economy in a particular at a particular point in time, but at the same time those nationalist impulses are constrained, at least to a certain extent, so you don't get a situation like you get in Slovenia, you get bank behavior which is both profitable and helpful in terms of the national economy. So it doesn't surprise me that in the Turkish case there are some instances in which domestically controlled and maybe state-owned banks have been credited there with helping, right? Because we have examples of that from elsewhere. But I will also tell you, in most of the cases, Latvia, Bulgaria, Slovenia, Italy, Portugal, Spain, very often those political relationships do end up causing many more problems than they solve. And so the issue is, you know, do you have in your country the political foundations for responsible and socially oriented banking, or is it exclusively about cronyism, or is it exclusively about exploitation and profit seeking to the exclusion of all other priorities? Right. So what I'm arguing in the book is that there is a way to strike a balance, but again, from an institutional point of view, it's not that easy to replicate across countries. It's a hard thing to achieve, but a few countries have it. To the extent that countries have this capacity, and then they lose all political susceptibility of their banking sector because of banking union or high levels of foreign bank ownership, those are the countries that stand to lose the most from the kind of transformation that I'm talking about.
Thanks, Jill. Abby had two fingers.
Sorry, it brings me to the methodological point, really, which is that for this idea of embedded discipline, it's the idea that Rachel puts forward to make this kind of virtuous setup. The only issue I have in the entire book, which is, you know, 182 pages and it's one issue, is this idea of party competition as a sufficient condition to discipline parties, to keep their hands out of the pot, basically, to keep their hands out of the financial pot. And I think one of the problems with that is that idea, that rationalist institutionalist idea that competition leads to government virtue. I think that that concept, which is a standard idea in political economy, it's in all the party literature on Central Europe, it's the main explanation in the party literature for democratic consolidation insofar as it exists in Central Europe, is they were competitive. That idea was developed in social science in the post-war era. So that idea that competition equals virtue has a lot of discrete normative optimism in it, and it assumes that if you have competitive parties, they can be completely effective, they can represent their citizens, they can express whatever conflicts there are in society and do something to resolve it. That's the kind of implicit assumption, because without that, you're going to have conflicts that may not turn out to be very compatible with liberal democracy. And it's a real, I think it's a real problem, and it leads you to put the cart before the horse in your descriptions of Hungarian and Polish politics, because you argue that competition is shut down by Fidesz and justice, law and justice, and that's why we end up with less virtuous behavior in the banking system. And I think what that misses is that those parties were elected on a very popular basis after the collapse of the social democratic left, which completely collapses in the region. Before these populist nationalist parties take the place of that left, that political space is opened up. So now in the Polish parliament, there isn't a single MP from the centre-left. And that's in a country where 42% of Poles identify themselves as social democratic. That's Swedish levels. But in order to prove that they were not communists, the left, the liberal left in Poland and Hungary, moved so far to the economic right in order to prove that they were not crypto-communists, that they abandoned their natural constituency and people stopped voting for them. So that collapse of the left, I mean, the corruption didn't help, but they ended up with no fiscal space, basically, because the growth model left no room to continue the social contract of supporting the unemployed and pensioners in the way that had happened at the beginning of the transition. And the problem with using a rationalist, institutionalist idea of competition as a sufficient condition is it takes ideology out of the picture. And actually, one of the things that I think we need to put back in to understand not just what's happening in Central Europe, but also in Britain and America, is that the economic orthodoxy of neoliberalism basically precludes an effective left over time. And this is why we have the populist nationalist reaction. So it doesn't demolish your analysis in any way at all, because I think the point is it's a necessary condition, competition, but it's not a sufficient condition. So then the question is, what are the additional things that you need? And I think you need an economic orthodoxy that's socially inclusive.
So I'll just respond quickly to that. I mean, in that chapter, the argument is not that political competition is by itself sufficient. The argument is, and this gets to your own observation about how important ideational factors and ideology are, is you get the best bank behavior when you have political competition and disciplining forces in connection with a certain kind of economic nationalism, which has at its core a striving for some degree of self-sufficiency and independence, which, of course, from an experiential point of view, the East European countries that I put up there early on in the talk with respect to foreign bank ownership lost. Mm-hmm. All right, so when it comes to Poland and Hungary, there's not been enough time that's passed to tell us, right, these were the two countries, just in response to your question, of all the countries that I looked at, where it looked like bank-state ties were constructive, more constructive there than in many other countries. And that if you were a Pole or Hungarian living in those countries during the crisis, you were very glad to have an OTP, if it were Hungary that we were talking about, or PKO in Poland, because these financial institutions really came to the service of the national economy in a way that the foreign-owned banks didn't. Right, and so what I say in the book, as Abby's referring to, is that I have some concern now about how these banks are going to perform and how the sectors are going to perform more generally because the ruling parties in these countries have really clamped down on the political competition that they face. And so does that open up the possibility that there will be a more instrumental and narrower use of financial institutions in these two countries that is in the interest, really, of power consolidation and not the broader economy? And so I think what we need to do is, you know, we'll wait and see and observe the effects of whether the relative absence of competition now has a negative effect on the financial sectors. My, you know, the hypotheses in the book would suggest, yeah, it is going to have a negative effect. You will get much more political intrusiveness in a way that compromises the functionality and performance of those financial institutions. That's what I hypothesize. But I don't think there's been enough time yet to know how things are going to turn out. What I'm arguing in the book is that at least at the time of the U.S. financial crisis hits Europe, these are the two countries, at least in Eastern Europe, that seem to have the most capacity for the productive use of their financial sectors.
In the second row, there are hands up. I'll cast my eye around to see if there are more hands.
Thank you. Alan Brenner from the Law Faculty, University College London. Very quick question. Are there really four drivers in terms of what's happening? One is, as you've mentioned, subsidiarization and the so-called balkanization of finance within Europe. The second one is to do with the effect of Basel III, CRD4, and the drive through risk-weighted assets towards, for liquidity and capital purposes, should be sovereign debt and property, secured debt, because they are the most beneficial for these terms. A third one is to do with profitability, that there's really not much point in investing in Western European banking markets because they either make very low margins or no margins at all, negative margins. And the fourth one is the one we really haven't touched upon, is shadow banking and the development of the non-banks as actors in this.
Sitting next to him will also want
do you,
to ask
yeah, do you want to add your question? Yes.
Thank you. My name is Lucas. I'm an alumnus of the European Institute. My question goes back to Walter's comment on central bank cooperation, because in fact we've seen two very different kinds of interactions between the core central banks and the countries where their banks had invested. We have kind of the Swedish models. Sweden's Riksbank, they gave a euro swap line to Latvia and one swap line to Estonia, which is not that often discussed, but that was in Swedish krona. So they even provide their own currency. Whereas the ECB, even though, as you said, European banks had, Eurozone banks had invested all over Eastern Europe, what they did was they gave repurchase agreement to Poland and Hungary. Poland decided instead to go to the IMF for a standby agreement instead of taking up that repo agreement. And countries like Romania went to the IMF to get their foreign exchange reserves straight away. So what? How would you explain that Sweden's central bank was so much more active in providing monetary assistance?
So I'll start with the first question, whether those are the drivers. So maybe I should ask for a clarification. Drivers of the supranationalization and oversight, or drivers in the transformation of bank-state ties, or drivers towards what? All of them? So what I think we're seeing in the evolution of Eurozone governance, let's say, with respect to bank oversight, is very much a response to the crisis dynamics. And as you I'm sure know, given the basis of your question, one of the central issues in the introduction of the euro in 1999 and what transpired after that is that the Europeans and the nation states, the member states in particular, were introducing a common currency while leaving national banking markets fragmented and under national control. And 1993 already, Barry Eichengreen published an article about how problematic this was going to be because of the particular nationalist competitive dynamics that would emerge that would make the Eurozone ultimately very vulnerable. So I think that analysis was correct. And what ultimately happened in the Eurozone crisis was the extent to which the, in this case, damaging effects of the political bank state ties were having in terms of the Euro's sustainability. So I'm not sure if this answers your question, but at this point in time, and I'd be interested to know what my other panelists think about this, it seems to me there are a series of dilemmas that the Europeans face in terms of how much discretion they have in managing their national economies versus how much energy and loss of discretion they want to put towards the sustainability of the common currency. And in a different world, you know, you would, I think under optimal circumstances, work on the cultivation of stronger bank state ties as a way of managing your national economy and ensuring your competitiveness. And I'm afraid that with the introduction of the euro, the Eurozone member states have really precluded, in a way, that option. And so the four drivers that you're talking about, I think, are a reflection of the more fundamental problems that manifest themselves in the bank state ties under conditions of having introduced a single currency. I will just speak to the issue of bank profitability, because this is an important one for what I think the architects of banking union see for banking union going forward, which is that West Europe, as you're pointing to, is overbanked. Profit margins are very narrow. This is one of the things that did drive West European investment on a huge scale into Eastern Europe, not just from Austria and Italy and France, but really from everybody, from Ireland, Portugal, the Netherlands. All of these multinational banking groups were moving into Eastern Europe in part because they faced this problem of very slim margins at home. So one of the arguments currently circulating from Bruegel, the think tank in Brussels, is precisely that there needs to be a marketization of West European banking in a way that encourages cross-national mergers and the elimination of, I'm sorry, lots of banks in Western Europe. So this is, though, the political fight that I think the Eurozone member states have set themselves up for. Because if you're talking about reducing banking capacity in a way in Western Europe, which is admittedly overbanked and not profitable, and therefore not very attractive to foreign investors, if you're the ECB and you're the single supervisory mechanism, you have to figure out a way, I think, to drive this forward using those kinds of concerns to, in a sense, reduce capacity but increase efficiency in the West European banking sector. And part of that also, I think, is probably rationalizing and narrowing the definitions of capital that banks can use as part of the regulatory framework. I think that's also under discussion. With respect to the Riksbank and its more active attitude, so there's a section in my book which I'm looking at the Baltic states in particular, and there are some very nice quotations from the Riksbank governor of the most intense crisis period. And essentially what he's saying is, we were as active as we were because we didn't see an alternative. If we did not bail out our own financial institutions, this was going to have negative repercussions on our country's credibility, on our own country's economies. And what he's saying, moreover, is that there are potentially very negative reputational effects. So, and he regrets all this, right? He is saying, my banks have been incredibly irresponsible, and ultimately their conduct in the Baltics means that there's less developmental opportunity at home. We're having to expend resources on this. Shame on these financial institutions. But essentially, we didn't have any choice. That the crisis was so intense and potentially punishing, also for the host countries from, or I should say the home countries from which these financial institutions were coming. I think the urgency with which different actors behaved is also linked to how precarious they felt their situation was. I think the Riksbank was a very good example of an institution that found itself in what it perceived to be a very precarious situation.
Okay. So you did have your hand up. Any more interventions? While you collect your thoughts, maybe I'll give it back to the panelists. Anything else that you wanted to probe?
Yes, I mean, because Rachel said, what is your take of it? On the first one, if we say that to some extent the Western European markets are overbanked and so on, then it's less puzzling that these banks want to stay in relatively profitable markets. Right. It has a relatively trivial commercial explanation. The second point that Lucas made, it comes back to my point why we institutions from the EU, but even beyond the EU, went massively into Central and Eastern Europe and helped them very early on. And don't forget, Hungary, Romania, all these countries had actually needed bailout programs before Greece and all the others, even though their macroeconomic indicators and so on were not worse, certainly not worse than Greek ones, which shows you everybody feared these countries, and was to some extent confirmed, these countries are extremely vulnerable because they have their own currency and have high foreign exchange debt. And the Swedish Riksbank was so active because it was very exposed in the Baltic countries, but also they had in 1990s, a big crisis. That central bank governor was then brought in to fight that crisis. He knew what this can mean for an economy, and he's today the head of the Basel Committee. For an obvious reason, he is a crisis fighter who knows what to do there, and therefore they really quickly knew we need to cooperate. And this is my point again. This was not so much, I do not see this rampant banking nationalism, but rather government surprisingly seeing very quickly we need to cooperate on this, otherwise we are all getting down into the maelstrom. It's the second phase where we thought, oh, we go now out of this crisis, and then that the markets pick up particular countries and it became a self-fulfilling affliction. Even Greece, I would defend, because Greece could have been written off some of its debt if one didn't fear a second Lehman moment. And in that sense, even Greece was a victim of that. We then let the markets just run rampant over these countries. But in the first phase, there was an idea, we are sitting in the same boat. These banks are the threat that drag us all down, and they're not something we can really rely on saving themselves.
I mean, I suppose as a non-banking person, I'd return a question to the banking experts in the audience and on the panel, which is, as a non-banking person, I'm very struck with European Banking Union, that on the one hand you have this impulse towards concentration in mergers and acquisitions, and on the other hand, and this is the question, do we know enough about optimal banking regulation that we want to have such a singular regulatory authority in charge of the Eurozone, in the sense of another great book to read. After you've read this one, I recommend Jens Becker and Richard Bronk's Uncertain Futures, which is about uncertainty in economics.
And book launch will be on 1st of November.
Be there. Be there or be slightly rhomboid. And one of the things they're really interested in is this. They make an analogy with biology, and that what's healthy in biology is diversity in terms of sustainability. And what they talk about is the risk of monoculture, that if the monoculture gets it wrong, you have no resilience. And so the question that raises for banking union is, do we know enough about what we're doing that we're not jumping out of the frying pan into the fire in terms of taking Eurozone problems and creating a whole bunch of them because of the unanticipated consequences of a very powerful regulatory authority, particularly if it reaches forward, if it's doing more than setting short-term interest rates, if it begins to get into any kind of long-term deterministic regulatory planning, do we know what we're doing if we do that? I have no idea. I'm not a finance person. What do the finance people think? It strikes me as risky on the basis of past experience. Anyone want to venture an answer to that?
It can't be any worse than it was before.
Well, that's an answer.
I think the point is that there are a number of jurisdictions that survived the financial crisis with highly concentrated banking models.
Right.
Australia and Canada come to mind, and Bordeaux is one on some of those. The higher area of competition, there's a school of thought which says actually that is highly destabilizing in terms of financial stability, and that you should actually go to a more concentrated market where you end up with banks which essentially are too big to fail, and also one to have a sort of a very clear symbiotic relationship with the government. The point I think on the ECB is the general view is that they simply could not trust in future the national governments to be able to extend. And the view is that you have to have something to do better than there was in the past, which cannot be answered.
Because one of the issues we haven't talked about at all, really, is financialization within the banking sector. You know, it's massive within the corporate sector, so and it's a rising trend across Europe, led by the British and the Americans, that large business corporations give out in share dividends and share buybacks greatly more than their net annual earnings. So to the tune of 150% of net annual profit in terms of UK FTSE 100 companies last year, which is amazing and completely unsustainable. And that trend also exists in banking in terms of high financialization, high risk-taking and so on, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon banking sector. And so that's a question how much that's a threat, a growing trend within the European banking sector, how much monetary union will be able to and willing to engage with that, prevent that.
So I'll just say on that, I mean, in a way, I think the Eurozone... monoculture is the wrong word, but part of what's happening, I think, in the discussions about financial reform going forward is there is an observation that probably Europe is too dependent on its banks for financing. Mm-hmm. Right? It's something like 280% of European GDP is what is the measure of banking assets in the United States, which understand is not always a good comparator in terms of a model of financial behavior, but it's 90%, right? And so when you're comparing the relative resilience of these two polities, if we can call them that, the United States in a way fared better, even though it was at the epicenter of the crisis, because it had many more different sources of finance than Europe currently does. Mm-hmm. There's a sense, I think, that that European finance is overly dominated by banks and that the economy would benefit from more diversification, and that part of what one could look forward to in the, let's say, resolution of overbanked markets is that you might see, with the emergence of capital markets union, more diverse sources of funding, which in a crisis would then provide more diversification, more resilience.
Yeah.
Right, so in a way, the emergence of European Banking Union doesn't strike me as the introduction of a monoculture so much as trying to address, I think, the weaknesses and vulnerability that already exist in European finance.
I think we probably have to leave it there, unless I overlooked any hands. But otherwise, I'll thank the panelists, Abby and Valtraud, and of course Rachel for coming,
thank
and thanks
so
a lot.
Thank
for
you.
Report.